United States Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit is now open according to law. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Good afternoon. Our first case for today is 2020-50343, United States versus Yurica Huerta. You may proceed with your argument.
May it please the court, Mr. Durbin. Given that the government has changed horses midstream here and now has a new theory to support the 2K2.1B6B enhancement, I want to point out to the court, this panel, exactly, in my opinion, what the government is asking this court to do. The government is asking this court to find facts which were not before the district court and which the district court didn't find. First one, the court is asking, or the government's asking this court to find that Mr. Badilla and Ms. Huerta entered into a joint undertaking to commit this purported other felony offense. Number two, Ms. Huerta's agreement as to this joint undertaking, and this is a quote from the government's brief, was a joint undertaking with co-defendant Badilla to obtain a distribution quantity of methamphetamine. Fact number three, Ms. Huerta either knew that this substance at issue was methamphetamine, or if she didn't know it, she knew that whatever the substance was is on the federal drug schedule. So, fact number four, Ms. Huerta's possession of the firearm, and this is a quote from the government's brief, was to facilitate a drug transaction that was planned, but that had not yet occurred. And the fifth fact that I have here is that this is attempted meeting between Badilla, Huerta, and Mr. Garza, who we never meet in this case, which never took place, was somehow an act in furtherance of the joint agreement between Ms. Huerta and Mr. Badilla. Now, in my opinion, I would suggest there are at least five reasons why the district court couldn't find any of these facts, and therefore this panel shouldn't find any of these facts either. First reason, the only place in the record where there's any reference of this planned meeting between Mr. Badilla, Ms. Huerta, and Mr. Garza was at the detention hearing. The detention hearing was before the magistrate judge, not the district judge. There's nothing in the record to suggest the district judge knew anything about or had anything on his radar screen regarding the content of what went on at the detention hearing. Number two, even if the district court had conducted the detention hearing, the testimony at the detention hearing wouldn't support the finding that the government wants it to support. The testimony that's relevant was from the Odessa narcotics detective, Detective Rogers, and he was specifically asked, because there was a question about whether this meeting, according to Mr. Badilla, did it have anything to do with drugs or did it have to do with a car? Okay, that went back and forth. First he said car, then he said drugs, then he said car. So the detective is asked, do you know if any of this was a part of a scheme to transfer guns in exchange for the car or transfer guns in exchange for any drugs? Detective Rogers, no, sir. So the only testimony at the detention hearing would be towards a finding that we don't know. There's nothing here that says this has anything to do with drugs. Okay, number three, the district court made no findings as to the scope of Ms. Huerta's agreement with Mr. Badilla regarding methamphetamine. Again, that's the government's theory. Since at least 2015, when 1B1.3 was amended, there's a very clear order of steps that a district court has to go through to determine whether conduct is relevant conduct under a jointly undertaken criminal activity theory. Number one, and this has to be in this order, is it within the scope of the jointly undertaken criminal activity? And again, the application notes that that's the very first consideration. You don't to get to in furtherance, you don't get to reasonably foreseeable until you get to, is it within the scope? Okay, and I would point, the reason it's significant The government's brief on page 15 cites to United States v. Rice, 11th Circuit case. But that case was a 2011 case. And the finding in that case that the government relies on was based on reasonable foreseeability. They never got to, was it within the scope of jointly undertaking criminal activity. But that's what this court is being asked to do by the government. You got to start with, was it within the agreement? Not whether it was reasonably foreseeable or in furtherance. You got to go in that order. And as part and parcel of whether it was within the agreement, if you've got a conspiracy, then part of that conspiracy to distribute requires knowledge on the part of the co-conspirators, or those who are part of this agreement. Well, after the McFadden case, I think it was 2016, there's two ways that you can establish that a co-conspirator has knowledge. Number one, either the defendant didn't know the name of the substance, but knew it was on the federal drug schedules, or actually did know the name of the substance. There's absolutely nothing in this record that would establish that Ms. Huerta had knowledge under either one of those methods, okay? Number four, again, one of the theories the government is proceeding on is under 2K2.1B6B is in close proximity to drugs. Were the guns in close proximity to drugs? Well, under this new theory, Mr. Badia and Ms. Huerta were never in actual or constructive possession of any methamphetamine. The only methamphetamine around was possessed by Ms. Velarde, and the government appears to have abandoned that theory, and I addressed that theory as best I could in my initial brief as to why that theory doesn't work, okay? And I'm not gonna repeat that, but if there's guns and no drugs, then you don't get a close proximity. You can't do it under close proximity. My authority for that is United States v. Seabee, 58 F3rd 161. It's a Fifth Circuit case. The government obviously makes no attempt to advance its theory under the 2 grams of methamphetamine that Mr. Badia had on his person, or the unidentified substance that Ms. Huerta had on this dollar bill. Possession amounts won't support the enhancement. Again, my authority for that is United States v. Jeffries, 587 F3rd 690, United States v. Caldwell, 770 Federal Appendix 175.
Can you help us? How do we know when something's a possession amount?
Well, I don't know that there's a line anywhere, but I think we can say that 2 grams, at least in Texas, 2 grams is a possession amount. We don't know the other substance. I don't know that any case says this is the line. The cases I've read say this one's over or this one's under. And, you know, so I don't know. The short answer is I don't know the answer to your question.
Okay. And I've been trying to get all the points because you've had a lot of points in rapid fire. And I'm sorry that if I may have missed something that you clearly already told us. But, okay, the fact that he asked her to go with him and bring her gun.
Right.
That's, and that you can't assume that he knew it was going for a drug meeting, right?
Well, was it for drugs or was it for the car? Again, the only testimony about that came from the detention hearing, which the district judge never heard. And the only testimony at the detention hearing from the detective was ambivalent. He had no way. And by the way, the detective didn't talk to Ms. Huerta or Mr. Badia. He only interviewed the arresting officers. And in his opinion,
would it be proper for the district court to rely on the detention hearing information, even if the district court didn't hear it?
It would if we knew. If it would, absolutely. If we knew that the district judge did rely on it, absolutely. Just like it would be proper for the district judge to rely on the video cam or body cam stuff that is discussed in this case if it had been introduced into evidence, but it never was. It's not part of the record. So my argument is that if we don't know that the district judge had it within his memory bank to consider, it's not fair or it's not proper for this judge to assume that he did. That would just be my argument. And number five, again, as I've argued in my reply brief, given that this is a new theory, it's reviewed for plain error. And the government's cites to the record, I mean, for clear error, for error to be plain, it's got to be clear. Now, the government, everything the government relies on asks this court to make an inference that's not necessarily obvious at all. For example, the government says Badia's carrying on his person more than $9,000 cash is consistent with the drug dealing objective of the intended meeting. Okay, it's consistent with. It's not obvious, though. Number two, as Badia advised police officers, because Huerta was his girlfriend, she was cognizant of this entire situation with the Gonzalez Motel meeting. Well, that's a real stretch. I mean, maybe she was, maybe not. She certainly denied that she was. Next one, Huerta's close association with Badia as his girlfriend supports her her participation in Badia's drug dealing objections. You're a girlfriend, therefore, whatever he's doing, you're doing. Okay, maybe you can infer that, but it's not obvious. Huerta, who had been unemployed for more than 1 year, was no stranger to drug possession. That doesn't make this agreement obvious in any way. Maybe. Okay, and then it says, and this is, I've already addressed this kind of, Huerta's and Badia's admissions, largely corroborated by video recordings, established their coordinated movements. Maybe, but we never, the recordings were never introduced. They're not in evidence. And so my argument is if the district court didn't have them before them, it's not proper. I'm suggesting this court can't take judicial notice and find out what's on them and then make a decision. That would be my argument. Okay, a couple of words now about the second issue here. And the government filed a supplemental notice of these two recent cases on the Fifth Circuit having to do with improper delegation. Interesting background of these cases. They both came out initially on, November 27th or October 27th. And Martinez was published, Fidel Guadalupe was not. They were utterly at odds with each other, in my opinion. The appellate attorney from Fidel Guadalupe filed a petition for panel rehearing, saying, guys, they say opposite things. One says you can't delegate to a probation officer the decision whether the treatment is going to be inpatient or outpatient.
You're aware of how that these were reissued and the harmonization. Assume we're aware of that. Can you cut to the chase because you're running out of time?
Yes, ma'am. I sure. Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. Yeah. When they were reissued, the Medell Guadalupe opinion, basically, I mean, they both affirmed everything they said before, but the Medell Guadalupe opinion added this, which wasn't in their first opinion. And it had to do with the fact that Martinez's sentence was 10 months, Medell Guadalupe's was 10 years. Okay. Due to the length of Medell Guadalupe's term, and I'm reading from the Medell Guadalupe opinion, a court cannot predict what the need for substance abuse treatment during supervised release will be. If upon his release nearly a decade from now, Medell Guadalupe disagrees with the inpatient-outpatient determination, the district court will have the final say over the decision. That stands for the proposition to me that any appellant who looks at this or anybody who's in prison and says, well, if I didn't argue it at the district court, didn't appeal it, if I don't like it and I got a sentence over 10 years, I can still take it up. Fifth Circuit previously says, no, you can't do that. And I'm reading here. I'll hustle up. This is.
Can you just tell us whether or not there's something?
Okay, in the Fifth Circuit, I'll cite the case.
No, I'm not asking what the case law is. I'm asking what has been delegated that you are objecting to.
Okay, I'm saying that a delegation under Medell Guadalupe is bad law because it's inconsistent with prior Fifth Circuit case law.
Right. But what has been delegated in your case that you object to? That's what
the probation officer still has the right under Model Guadalupe to delegate inpatient or outpatient treatment.
No, and that's improper. That was an issue in your case.
I don't believe there's
inpatient outpatient issue. There's no discussion of inpatient outpatient, is there?
Okay. Can I finish my sentence and then I'll shut up?
Yes, sir. I'm trying to figure this out. I'm not trying to be argumentative,
okay,
sir. I'm trying to figure out. In Martinez,
the condition specifically said that the probation officer could delegate inpatient or outpatient.
Yes, sir. I'm really familiar with Martinez.
Miguel Guadalupe, yes, ma'am, and I believe you were part of the opinion. I understand it. I did Mr. Guadalupe's deal, and that's why I'm a little familiar with his. Okay. His didn't say that. But the general terms of the authority given to the probation officer would allow the probation officer to do that, in my opinion. And I'm arguing that's improper.
But the district court didn't say that they're letting the probation officer in the future do anything like that, right? You're just imagining that might happen in some future day. I'm just trying to be fair here. Is that right?
The language of the condition allows the probation officer to determine, first of all, treatment's ordered.
Right.
So is it going to be inpatient or outpatient? The other language in the opinion, and I cut me off at any time because I know I'm over here. It says,
there's been no inpatient treatment ordered in this case, right?
There's been no delegation you're
to
right.
the probation officer to make a determination. In those other cases, there was a delegation to make the determination. In this case, there's no delegation of that.
Not specifically.
Sort.
You're right. Not specifically.
Okay. So there's no problem as long as the district court doesn't delegate that to the probation officer.
What if the probation officer does it on her own?
Then you can always go back and say that wasn't in the judgment.
Well, and I'm going to say under the prior Fifth Circuit case law, if you didn't raise it at sentencing or on appeal, you can't raise it at a revocation hearing.
You certainly raised it here today, sir, and in your brief. Thank you. I think we have your argument, and you saved time for rebuttal. And Mr. Durbin, let's hear from you about this, please, on your argument.
All right. You'd like me to start with the application of the guideline?
Yes, sir. I think that's the primary argument in the case.
Okay. I look at this guideline, and I look at the record. And the first question that I had as I picked this up was, all right, what is the other felony offense that's at work here? We've got possession of a firearm by Ms. Huerta. In fact, she possessed two firearms, as I read the record. She possessed each of them at different times. The circumstance, and so the guideline actually allows for application of this under two circumstances. And as I read it, one is if the defendant used or possessed the firearm in connection with another felony offense. And I think that means a felony offense that the defendant commits. And then the second clause in it permits application of it if the defendant possessed it with knowledge, intent, or reason to believe that it would be possessed or used in connection with another felony. I think the record here supports both of those. But I think that the district court made its determination on the first, that is based on a finding or a determination that Ms. Huerta was in a conspiracy with others. The scope of the conspiracy was not real clear, but the probation officers, the pre-sentence report, in response to the objection, specifically found that Huerta's co-defendant, who is Badia, was in possession of almost $10,000. And Velarde, there's another player here. Velarde was in possession of 81.6 grams of methamphetamine. These items are indicative of drug trafficking. And the factual circumstances, as I see them in the record, are, and it includes testimony by an officer of the OPD at the detention hearing is that they got a call from the Super 8 motel. They showed up to the motel. They got a call for a person with a gun. They found four people outside the motel that appeared to be together. And Mr. Huerta dropped a gun and the officer heard it. Ms. Velarde, who is charged in a separate related case, she is not charged in this case, but she dropped 81.6 grams of methamphetamine in a baggie onto the ground. And then Ms. Huerta was found holding an AK-47 pistol, automatic or semi-automatic. And there was a fourth person there, Marquez, who had 5 grams of methamphetamine. Now, according to the testimony of the officer during the detention hearing, he interviewed Badilla. And Badilla said he went to the Super 8 motel to meet with a guy named Alan Gonzalez. And Gonzalez is also charged with Velarde in that related case. It's number 249, I believe, in the district court. They were both indicted on the same day. These two were indicted on guns. The others were indicted on a methamphetamine conspiracy. First, he says he was going to buy a car. Then he says, no, he was going to get 15 pounds of meth from Alan Gonzalez. And then he kind of goes back to, well, no, there's a car story. Both Huerta and Badilla identify her as Badilla's girlfriend. And then later, they both say that she wasn't. And Frank Badilla said, or she said that Badilla told her, let's go to the Super 8 motel. You're going to be armed. And he gave her the Sig Sauer pistol. And then after they were leaving, he gave her, they exchanged guns, and she ended up with the AK-47. They went to the room where Gonzalez supposedly was. We don't know why they didn't get to see him, but they didn't. But as they were leaving, the police showed up. So there are four people at, yes, ma'am.
Couple of questions.
Yes.
Opposing counsel says that I know you said you've been citing from the PSR. It says that they're relying on things from a hearing, a detention hearing, as part of this, that is not part of the record before the district court. Can you address that? And then my second question is, what is the evidence that Ms. Huerta actually knew, even that this was some sort of drug deal going on, and just the fact that she's a girlfriend doesn't establish that?
That's right. I agree with that. As far as
answer both of those questions,
the detention hearing being part of the record, it's part of the record on appeal. I can't attest to what the district court may or may not have read, but I think that as part of the record on appeal, we can assume that
before the district court at the time that he was making his decisions,
did he have the actual transcript of the detention hearing?
Or have knowledge of what had happened? Could the district court have relied upon that? And did the district court rely upon that?
I believe so, because during the sentencing hearing at page 111 of the record, there was some back and forth, and the district court said, the response by the probation officer is certainly telling. Ms. Huerta and Ms. Velarde, one of the four of them who were there, are co-defendants in the possession of this money, which is almost $10,000, and possession of some 81.5 grams of methamphetamine, which certainly are indicative of drug trafficking, and there is a firearm. And Ms. Huerta's counsel objected, well, they're not charged together. And the judge's response was, but that doesn't keep Ms. Velarde and Ms. Huerta from being co-conspirators, correct? So I believe the district court was aware of the circumstances that were going on at the time the police showed up at the Super 8 motel, because I believe this indicates that the district court's determination in this particular matter was based on the district court's finding that Ms. Huerta participated in a drug conspiracy, and that in connection with that, she possessed this firearm, and accordingly, and there were 81 grams of methamphetamine found that Ms. Velarde had disposed of during the time that the police showed up. And there was reference to, it's not in the record, but it's referenced as information that the probation officer, I believe, looked at, as well as offense reports, that these people were seen together as though they were operating or they were coordinating or cooperating, but they somehow knew each other at the motel. And from those circumstances, I think that was the basis for the district court's determination that there was a conspiracy. Now, as far as Ms. Huerta's knowledge, the transcript of the detention hearing does not say that she knew that there were drugs. We don't have that. She didn't have drugs on them. What we do have, though, is she shows up with Mr. Badilla at the Super 8 Motel. Mr. Badilla is going to do, he's looking into a drug transaction. He's looking for 15 pounds of meth that he hasn't received. And he tells her, and you're going to carry a gun. Now, I doubt that she was going, or under the impression that she was going to look for cars. That's not usually the way used cars are purchased, and you usually don't need two weapons to purchase a car at a motel. Mr. Badilla told the police when interviewed, he first gave this nonsense about the car, which I think the court could certainly say that's not credible. He's trying to make up a story, and he came around. He finally told the truth. He told the police he was going for 15 pounds of methamphetamine. Well, if he told the police, I think it's a fair inference by the district court that he told Ms. Huerta as well. And Ms. Huerta was not the first time at this kind of a dance. She's got a history. She was convicted of a drug offense about a year or 2 years ago, and she was arrested in a motel room with drugs and a firearm. And sometime after that, she was involved in another case that the charges are still pending. She was in a car that fled in a police chase, and the car had drugs, a gun, and a digital scale. So Ms. Huerta is not somebody who has no idea where she was or doesn't understand what the circumstances were. And the question here is whether the district court's finding on this was clear error or whether his finding was plausible based on the record as a whole. And I submit to the court that based on these circumstances, the district court's determination that she was involved in a conspiracy, at least by a preponderance of evidence, and had that gun in connection with that conspiracy, I believe the district court's findings should be upheld. It should be affirmed. I also think, and I don't want to change horses again, but I also think that all of those facts also clearly establish that she had reason to believe that that gun was going to be used in connection with a drug offense, a drug conspiracy. And I think the court can uphold the district court on any basis that's in the record. And I think that there's sufficient information to support the district court. I mean, what we had is guns, a lot of money, drugs at the motel. And under those circumstances, the district court made the determination that those guns were in connection with a felony drug offense. And based on her background and the circumstances, she knew enough to be held accountable. So I submit to the court that the district court's finding was not clearly erroneous. Oh, and turning to the issue of the super, did I answer both of your questions, Judge Elrod?
Yes, sir. I think that you did. I'm just, other than her presence, the indications are that she didn't have employment, that the detective told someone else after he was caught what he was doing. I mean, that her employment, you know, her colleague, Mr. Badilla, told somebody else, told Detective Rogers.
Yes.
But it's kind of.
Plus her background and experience.
Isn't it?
I'm not going to tell you that it would be sufficient to convict her of a conspiracy beyond a reasonable doubt. That's not the question before us, and that would be a tough case. I think that's probably the reason she was charged with a firearms offense and not charged in the drug conspiracy. But I think that those circumstances, together with her background, and I think her criminal history and the circumstances that are set forth in the pre-sentence report, from those, the district court could reasonably find she wasn't there with a gun at the motel with Mr. Badilla and with these other people, one of whom had about 3 ounces of methamphetamine. She had enough knowledge to be held accountable under this particular guideline. And the district court's finding was not clear error under these circumstances.
And there's not evidence that she was under the control of him?
The testimony or her statement, as I understand it, was She had known him for about 2 weeks and had been messing around with him, but she had a full-time, she had a regular boyfriend. But she acknowledged that she told police that night that he was her boyfriend, but that wasn't true. They'd known each other for about 2 weeks and they were messing around.
Okay. Did you have anything further on that point, or maybe one of my colleagues has a question?
I believe that covers it. What I've got, the record is not lengthy, and it is what it is. On the supervised release, I don't have a whole lot to add to it. I'm not real sure what the impermissible delegation was.
I think that he's concerned that an impermissible delegation will occur in the future.
Well,
that,
you know,
that somehow that there will be the probation officer will eventually decide to go inpatient, and he wants to make sure he can't, that probation officer can't do that in the future. Agree that you can't in the future do that. If they did try to do that in the future and it was an improper delegation, they could raise that at some future time.
I think they could, Judge. And here's my trouble with this is the way I understand it would probably operate. She's got a 52-month sentence. She's going to be in the Bureau of Prisons. I think it's very likely that she'll have drug abuse treatment in the Bureau of Prisons. And there's very likely to be a question when she comes out, does she need further drug abuse treatment? I would assume that if she's had treatment and doesn't indicate that there's further need for it, the probation officer is going to at some point recommend, okay, you don't need any more of this right now. And I also assume that the probation officer is going to sit down with her and say, okay, well, I think that outpatient is going to be fine. He may say inpatient may be fine. If she agrees with him, is that an improper delegation? If she disagrees with him, she's got a means for getting it before the district court. Right. That
if
is,
the,
she,
if the district court defers to the probation officer without making his or her own decision, then that's a problem.
Well, I think if she says, no, I'm not going inpatient, then the probation officer has to take it to the district court. Okay. It has to get there.
I think this, we're clear that this is what can be delegated and what cannot.
And, okay. And I don't think it's been.
Is there something else that you wish to say, Mr. Durbin?
That is all I have, Your Honor.
Did any of my colleagues have a question for Mr. Durbin? Okay, I think we have your argument, sir.
Thank you.
Mr. Jerry, you saved time for rebuttal.
Yes, ma'am. I have four comments. First of all, just on the whether Ms. Huerta is getting drug treatment in prison, given that there are guns involved in this offense, I don't know this, but I'm going to guess she's not eligible. Moving back now, I maybe misunderstood Mr. Durbin, but I thought I understood him to say that the district court made a finding that Ms. Huerta and Mr. Padilla were involved in a joint agreement involving drugs. Now, if he didn't say that, great. I just misunderstood him, but I don't see that anywhere. That was never before the court. And as to, it sounds like the government is backing up now and relying some on this Velarde testimony. But the government in its brief said, and this is on page 23, on the basis of Huerta's own relevant conduct, irrespective of Velarde's criminal involvement or the proximity of Huerta's firearm to the methamphetamine Velarde possessed, the enhancement applies. That sounds awful close to an abandonment to me. Again, obviously, that's a question of law for this court to decide. So, it's not clear to me why he would want to back up and rely on that when he's disabused himself of that theory earlier. Last but not least, and this is important, Mr. Durbin read from 2K2.1b6, this is the possible grounds to rely on for upholding this finding. Okay, and I'm going to read B in its entirety. If the defendant used or possessed any firearm or ammunition in connection with another felony offense, or, and this is the significant part, or possessed or transferred any firearm or ammunition with knowledge, intent, or reason to believe it would be used or possessed in connection with another felony offense. The theory relied upon by the government is the first part. The only time it's ever been mentioned, the second part, is by Mr. Durbin today. And that second part doesn't have anything to do with the facts of this case. That has to do with a situation where an individual transfers guns to another person, typically to be transferred to somebody else. And the Martinez case that the government cites in his brief addresses that. But that case is inapposite to this case, in my opinion, for the reasons that I've just suggested. And I think that's reinforced by the application notes here in application note 14. Application 14 specifically addresses drug trafficking. In the case of drug trafficking offense, in which the firearm is found in close proximity to drugs, drug manufacturing materials, or drug paraphernalia. Okay. There's nothing in this application note that has anything to do with the reason to believe language from that other provision. This, in my opinion, is brand new. This is a new argument that has nothing to do with the facts of this case, and that, frankly, the government is presenting it for the first time at oral argument. So other than that, those are my only comments.
Well, I believe we have your argument. And hearing no further questions, I think the case is submitted. And we appreciate you both appearing today virtually so that we can conduct this argument. Thank you.